Welcome to I'm Spiritual, Damn It. I'm your host, Jennifer Weigel, and joining me on the phone, Daniel Drazen, media producer, filmmaker, near-death experience investigator, and I would say also an expert on electronic voice phenomenon. Would that be correct, Daniel?
That would be correct, and thank you, Jen, and it's wonderful to be here with you on your program.
You know what? We're excited that we've got you coming to the Chicago area. So for listeners who are just tuning in, there are two opportunities to see Daniel and his work. First, he'll be at the Wilmette Theater on September 7th at night. I'll be introducing you. You'll be showing one of your films. And then you'll be presenting at the Chicago IONS meeting on Saturday at Evanston Hospital at the Frank Auditorium, 3 to 5 in the afternoon, chicagoions.org. That's I-A-N-D-S. ChicagoIANDS.org to find out more about that. But let's talk about some of your work and your research, Daniel. When did you first become, you know, intrigued by near-death experiences and the phenomenon of EVP, which is electronic voice phenomenon?
Well, excuse me. You might say that it goes back to my childhood when I experienced quite a number of precognitive dreams. And this was very intriguing to me because it told me that some way, somehow, stuff goes on behind the scenes, backstage, that there is more to our reality than we are brought up and socialized to believe. Now, this didn't give me all the answers, but at least it made me skeptical of the idea that the reality that we believe we inhabit is the whole picture.
Right.
And since then, I've been looking into various avenues or windows into this larger reality, you might call it.
Absolutely. And you know, with your research, what I like is that you bring in so many scientists and internationally renowned researchers into these different fields. And a lot of them, you know, starting off as skeptics or some of them being skeptics, but the scientific research that comes to the table by people who are these different specialists, and especially with the electronic voice phenomenon, it's really, really compelling stuff.
Well, thank you. Yes, I think that in some ways, certain of the sciences are about to undergo what our early sciences underwent in the Renaissance, prior to which we felt, for example, that the Earth was the center of the universe.
Right.
I mean, what could have been more obvious than that the Earth was the center of things?
Right.
The problem was that certain things didn't add up. For example, the movements of the planets didn't make any sense. And there was this very complicated so-called Ptolemaic system, which more or less explained these random movements of the planets. But when the sun finally got, put in the center of things, all of a sudden everything fell into a very simple, natural pattern. We understood the movements of the planets on a much different basis. Everything started to make sense, and so many other things started to make sense as well. Well, I think that at this point in time and in the near future, some of our sciences are going to undergo a similar shift in point of view. And it's actually a rather simple shift. There's nothing really that complicated about it. It's just that it goes against what seems to be our intuitive sense of things. That simple shift being that consciousness itself is at least equal to that of matter and energy as a foundation of reality.
And once we embrace that, then we can understand how it can continue with the evidence that you present. Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Right. No. And it validates and vindicates much of parapsychology as it's been practiced over recent decades. It validates some aspects of traditional religion, so not all. And it reveals traditional religions as at least metaphorical references to the notion of an eternal soul or a continuing soul as distinct from our embodiments and our personal lives. So I think both science and religion may come a little closer together as part of this process, but they're not going to be quite the same as they've been. There's a third way, if you will. And that is once consciousness is considered as a foundation, perhaps the foundation of reality, everything starts getting, many things start falling into place, let's put it that way. And the things which are unthinkable to materialist science now may start becoming quite thinkable and quite appropriate to investigate on a level playing field.
I want to talk about some of your investigations here for a second, please. Especially in Calling Earth, you have many examples of where people put out these recording devices and they are trying to reach their, you know, loved ones who are on the other side and get some sort of messages that come back. And they are clear as day, these messages. Hi, Mom. Love you, Mom. I'm here in the light. You know, all these things. These messages that a lot of skeptics will say are hoaxes, are, you know, and of course, you know, it's easier to think that it's a hoax and somebody's just manipulating the audio recording than to think that somebody is putting out a device and getting these conversations as they're happening. But for those who've never had this happen or listened to some of this evidence, what are some of the cases that you found the most compelling, Daniel?
Oh, it would be hard. It would be hard to zero in on the most compelling ones.
Right.
I do want to say just for a moment about skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
That skepticism, the proper place for skepticism is as part and parcel of the scientific method.
Sure.
It's an essential part of the process of scientific investigation. But when skepticism sort of escapes the cage and strikes out on its own as a sort of a cult or religion, it can be very destructive. And as we all know, it can morph from something like a rational investigation into a rather emotionally based sort of negativity.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not science, as far as I'm concerned. And this has been a concern of mine for some years, that many people who do not understand the process of science confuse science with skepticism. They are two completely different things.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah, no, I'm so glad you said that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, some of the examples of excellent EVP and of instrumental transcommunication, which is a larger subject, communication through instruments.
Right.
Some of the best examples that I can think of involve a gentleman, a European gentleman by the name of Konstantin Raudova,
mm-hmm.
who was a psychologist and philosopher and professor. He passed away in 1974, and he has come through through various kinds of technologies, audio, video, photography, and so on, to many of his former colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
And he uniquely has been able to conduct conversations lasting several minutes, which is sort of a record in this field. We don't understand what either facilitates or impedes this process.
Mm-hmm.
Most electronic voice statements or utterances, as they're called, really only last a few seconds.
Right.
Maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Raudova's skill, for whatever reason, allowed him to maintain conversations of several minutes. And you'll see and hear some of these conversations in my film.
Yes, I was very blown away by that in Calling Earth, in those conversations, because they weren't just love you, Mom, or the light, or, you know, they weren't just phrases. They were actual conversations, and you could hear the inflection of this person's voice and the accent. I mean, it was mind-blowing. And then and other, you know, evidence with all the research in the movie Skole, S-C-O-L-E, by the way, is a small town in England, where was it 5 years, Daniel? There was research where they had these people in the basement and did extensive research, monitored by scientists to make sure that there was nothing fraudulent going on or no scams happening. And these app port incidents, where literally objects appeared out of nowhere, from a newspaper from 1944 to old coins, they appeared in the room. And everybody that was present was just as amazed and shocked at this happening. This is amazing stuff. This is unbelievable evidence, incredibly convincing evidence.
Right. Well, the Skole experiment, as it was known, mm-hmm. is probably the best known example of what's called physical mediumship,
mm-hmm.
In which physical phenomena are produced, which can be preserved, recorded, and so on, and then studied later.
Right.
This experiment went on for a period of 5 years, from about 1994 through 1999, in this very small town called Scholes, about a half hour northeast of Cambridge, mm-hmm. in the Norfolk area. And it was conducted primarily by two couples. One of the couples were talented mental mediums and mm-hmm. trance mediums, and the other couple were researchers who had been interested in physical mediumship all their lives, actually, and had written several books about it. During the course of the Scholes experiment, the mental mediums would go into trance. They would connect with what they call the spirit team on the other side, mm-hmm. a group of deceased entities who with whom they cooperated to come up with experiments to perform. And slowly these experiments developed into quite evidential things. For example, at one point they were asked to put a and this, by the way, these were conducted in near total darkness.
Completely, because the lights might affect the energy of those, you know, signals and those experiments. Is that correct? They wouldn't be as evidential?
That's the general idea. Mm-hmm. Now, in order to preclude fraud and so forth, certain controls were imposed.
Yeah.
Everyone wore luminous wristbands.
With Velcro, so they couldn't be ripped off. You would hear it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. The table around which they sat had luminous tabs on it, as did every movable object in the room.
Right.
The table itself was constructed so no one could reach underneath it and manipulate things and so on. Mm-hmm. Now, just back to one of the most interesting examples, I think, were the photographic experiments.
Unbelievable.
Where the, quote, spirit team mm-hmm. Asked the experimenters to put a camera on the table. It was loaded with 35-millimeter film, conventional old-fashioned camera.
Right.
During the session, they heard the camera levitate around them in a circle, the shutter being clicked, and yeah. the camera being redeposited on the center of the table.
Right.
Then they were asked to develop the film. Mm-hmm. What showed up on the film was a series of 11 black and white photographs. This is on color film, by the way.
Right.
11 black and white photographs that they were told were copies of photos that existed somewhere in the world. They were only able to track down a few of these. They did determine that they were quite good copies of these photos. Others they could not track down.
Right.
Later, they were instructed to put the roll of film in the center of the table without the camera.
In fact, it was in the package, still sealed. Correct?
Yes. Correct.
Okay. Okay.
Correct. And when the visiting scientists were there for a period of several years, the scientists would buy the film themselves, and they would actually hold the film in their laps in a locked box while these experiments were going on. Mm-hmm. To preclude any sort of tampering or hoaxing.
Right.
And with these films, what they got were whole lengths of film, 3 or 4 feet long, with drawings, puzzles, writing in various languages, whimsical patterns, and so on. And also the signatures of well-known individuals. And you can see these in the film compared yes. with the original signatures.
Right.
They were at one point requesting help with a particular technical experiment they were doing. Mm-hmm. And the response came in the form of a diagram on one of these 35-millimeter films. and the diagram was signed by Thomas Edison.
Amazing.
They sent away to the Edison Foundation that provided them with a copy of Edison's signature, and the two matched very closely.
Right.
So these were a number of the highly evidential examples that when you really look into this, the amount of work, time, and expense that would have been required to fake any one of these things, let alone these hundreds and hundreds of results, mm-hmm. Would have been astronomical.
You know, and it's interesting, too, because these are people that are putting their time, energy, and efforts that have reputations. You know, they're scientists, they're internationally renowned researchers. Why would they risk their reputation to be behind a hoax. I get this a lot in my work, Daniel, where Manhattan medium Thomas John, I did a blind circle in, you know, where I provided the people that he could not possibly research ahead of time to, like you say, take away all of that guesswork of, well, maybe he's researching them, maybe he's Googling them, maybe he's Facebooking them and getting all this background information to find out that they had a dead dog or a dead parent, you know, whatever it is. And so when there is no way that he could know who these people were ahead of time, and he's bringing up all these things and all these people, that was my way of doing the research. And yet still people accused me of not being on the up and up. Did you find there was some backlash with the skull experiments still, even with all this evidence and the film being put, I mean, still in its container? I mean, it hadn't even been unwrapped, and yet all these images were found on the film, and these scientists were holding it in their lap. Was there still some backlash from the skeptics?
Well, skeptics will always find a way.
Right.
And their methodology of choice usually consists of generalization, mm-hmm. broad generalization, ridicule, dismissal prior to inquiry, and
right.
so forth. I think the best retort to a skeptic is to say, okay, you duplicate this phenomenon under identical conditions, and then we'll talk about it.
Right.
And of course, they never do.
Right. And so for those who are at home listening and they want to try to see if they can get some electronic voice phenomenon from their loved ones on the other side. A lot of the tips that they had from calling Earth were back when we had tape recorders. So now that we're in the digital, all digital zone, Daniel, what would you recommend for people in their efforts to try to see if they can get some little, you know, love messages from their loved ones? Because to me, a lot of this evidence that you bring forth is not only proof that the soul lives on and that the spirits can talk to us from the other side, but that they're concerned about us and they want to help us through the grief. And that when they first transition over, as some of these children show in your movie Calling Earth, that they are grieving too. They're missing their family and they're in transition as they get used to their new surroundings. So how would you recommend people try to connect with their loved ones through EVP?
Well, in the film itself, there's one sequence devoted to how to do EVP, if mm-hmm. you'd like to. The technology really matters less. The film was made between 1994 and the early 2000s, mm-hmm. and so there's a lot of earlier tape technology there. But one can still access tape cassette recorders. They're still available. And I would actually recommend them because they're quite simple. Anyone can use them. And one of the theories involving how the voices actually appear on the tapes has to do with a subtle noise that's part of any recording system.
Mm-hmm.
Even the highest quality recording system produces a very small amount of background noise. But the earlier technologies weren't quite so good. And their background noise was more prominent. And as a result, some people theorize, this noise provides a better sort of raw material from which these voices can be created and synthesized.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one option. You can also use your computer if you have audio recording software.
Mm-hmm.
It does not need to have a microphone because however this process takes place, it's not dependent on voices being picked up acoustically. We don't know how it works. All we know is that the practitioner, what we know with fair certainty is that the most important thing is the emotional bond or connection between the practitioner and the deceased individual.
Mm-hmm.
The technology matters less, actually. So there's you can have a wide range of choices there.
Got it.
But the main thing is to be able to focus on the individual.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that seems to work is to keep the same time each day to try to make the contact, say in the evening in a quiet hour when there's not a lot of noise in the environment, and to do it at the same time every day.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is to not be passive, to ask questions.
Right.
And put your energy out as well. So however this process takes place, it requires intention. And again, if consciousness is the basis of all these things, then intention obviously is a very important part of it.
Now, I want to ask about intention for a quick second. With all of the messages that came through, not just from Calling Earth, but in the Skoll experiments, from some of these, you know, great thinkers from years gone past, and even mediums from the past, what was some of the, you know, the common themes? What were some of the through lines, if you will, of the messages that they wanted to impart to us? I know that some of it was that drugs are dangerous and that violence is, obviously they want us to not be violent toward each other. But what else were they trying to get us versus we are here, isn't that great? There had to have been some deeper meaning in some of those conversations.
Right. The more extensive the conversation, the deeper the meanings were able to come through. Basically, it comes down to the same old thing, that the more conscious we are, the more conscious we endeavor to be, the more loving we are. Mm-hmm. The more we realize that we are not as separate as we believe ourselves to be while we're in these human bodies. In a sense, one of my favorite metaphors for this is that when we're in our bodies and believe ourselves to be our bodies, we're kind of like raisins in a bowl. We're these separate objects with skins and boundaries. But that beyond this physical world, we're sort of more like lumps in chocolate pudding. That we are made of the same substance as the environment and the same substance everyone else is made of, and that our boundaries are more permeable, and that we can feel more directly the results of our actions and our attitudes on other people. As you probably know, in most accounts of near-death experiences where people report having had a life review, the dominant, the most powerful part of that experience is the realization of what our actions felt like to others with whom we were engaged at the time. And that's a huge lesson.
Yeah.
The suggestion is, of course, that even whether we know it or not, and whether we experience it or not, when we're sort of encased and armored in these bodies, there is a field of interaction that continues to exist. And that when we are free of our bodies, we almost automatically experience the totality of every interaction. Including the other person's experience.
You know, I'm sure you're familiar, of course you are, with Paul Perry and his near-death experience investigations. He's written, I think, maybe 9, maybe 10 books on the subject. And one of the things he talked about as a skeptical journalist who continues to research these near-death experiences was that he found that the children's stories were the most compelling because they didn't have the preconceived knowledge of what a near-death experience was, of the research. They weren't Googling NDEs. They weren't reading about Dr. Mary Neal, Into Heaven and Back. They were just kids who had these experiences, and there were so many common things that happened, so many similarities, so many exact reactions, and as you mentioned, the life review and so forth, of this unconditional love and so on. So for the children to have these similar experiences when they're not comparing notes, I find that very, very compelling. But now, of course, with the many adults that I've interviewed who have died and lived to talk about it, as we say, do you think some of these EVPs, Daniel, are a result of a spirit that is not in the light and perhaps staying closer to this level to help our loved ones through their grief? Or are they spirits that are in the light? Is it a little combination of both?
Well, the way different people see this in different ways, the way I prefer to see it, and I think the evidence pretty much supports this, is that what we call the afterlife or the greater reality consists of an infinity of different levels. We can think of them as discrete levels. You can picture it, say, as a multi-story building, if you will. And we down here, maybe in the basement of the first floor. And as after we're through with this life, we may find ourselves in an environment represents the second or third or fourth floor, depending on our predilections, on the evolvement of our soul, if you will, and so on. And so we can speak in rough terms of levels. In order to communicate with say, a medium on Earth, one can be maybe, say, at the second or third or fourth level because a talented medium can sort of reach up and meet them halfway. to communicate with our technology, which is not inherently conscious, folks have to be pretty close to the earth plane, say on the second level, maybe the third, mm-hmm. but mostly the second level. So I think that's sort of a rough schema or diagram, if you will, of how these things work. Now, for individuals like Konstantin Radova, whom I mentioned earlier, some people suspect that he actually resides in a somewhat higher level and has mastered the discipline of coming down closer to the earth plane mm-hmm. so that he can communicate with us in a more extensive way. There's evidently some discomfort, if you will, in coming down too close to the earth plane, mm-hmm. as reported by a number of afterlife communications. So I think the best we can do is to sort of have a rough idea of how all this works. I doubt that we will have any more precise idea until we ourselves are on the other side and have a much broader and more open view of how this all works. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I think I may have sort of gone off on a tangent here.
No, that's good. That's really important. And so I wonder, too, in your decades of doing all this research, Daniel, do you find yourself today believing something different than maybe 3 decades prior when you were starting out? Has something in your belief system changed either by having more evidence or more compelling circumstances or having discussions with different scientists?
That's a very good question. I have to say that when I first started out looking in this particular direction, I've had already been quite interested in so-called paranormal phenomena. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, when I was first introduced to instrumental transcommunication, electronic voice phenomenon, and so forth, I was kind of skeptical. I needed to dig into it for a while before I could accept it. Mm-hmm. And then I did. I found it quite compelling and quite convincing. Mm-hmm. My first, when I use the phrase so-called paranormal, I think it's important to note that we put this social label of paranormal on certain categories of experiences and research. But that's not a scientific definition. It's a social definition. Mm-hmm. How do we know whether something is paranormal or normal if we can't talk about it?
Right.
We just don't know. How do we know that our next-door neighbor doesn't talk to their dead uncle every Wednesdays?
Right.
We can't. The whole idea that we're dividing reality into normal and paranormal is, I think, a very highly questionable practice. Mm-hmm. So, we're constrained to use conventional language, and when I use the term paranormal, I think you probably know what I'm talking about.
Right.
And I think we also have to be very careful of the semantics and conceptual frameworks here, because things are undergoing a great deal of change in this area, mm-hmm. and there would be, I'm sure, a period of confusion while the language gets sorted out. I mean, we've got a little bit of scientific language here, a little bit of traditional religious language, traditional metaphysical language, and so on.
Right.
So this whole field is in flux. But I find it extremely exciting. I'm delighted to be around at this time with all this ferment happening. Mm-hmm. And I look forward to this research to continue, and also for more people to come out of the woodwork mm-hmm. with their own experiences and to be more courageous and forthright about reporting what they have seen and experienced.
And also, too, you know, over 250 million people believe that Jesus came back from the dead and you know, believe in Christianity when we didn't even have the ability to record the evidence the way that we do now with EVPs and ITCs, you know, and just that was word of mouth and chiseling things onto, you know, templates. And that's, right. You know, yet people are absolute in their belief that this happened. Well, now here we are with all of these experiments, the skull experiment, let alone for 5 years with scientists and specialized, you know, all this equipment, you know, all of this documented evidence, and people are still going, well, I'm not so sure. You know, eventually we're going to have to realize, just like we did when we figured out that the world wasn't flat, like you say, there's enough right. stuff on the plate for us to see that there's a different meal being presented.
Right. And you know, some of the skepticism and resistance, I think, is perfectly understandable.
Yeah.
People in the scientific and academic communities have to maintain their reputations. They got to put food on the table. and so on. You know, we all have our human circumstances that that compel us to perhaps not always being at the leading edge of things.
Mm-hmm.
But so this process, the process of paradigm shift, takes a while.
Yeah.
And usually what happens is there's always resistance and skepticism and so on and so on. And then one morning, everyone wakes up and they just sort of accept it.
No. All right. I hope we're still around when that happens, Daniel.
Well, we may or may not be. The longer I mess around in these fields, mm-hmm. The more I have to come to terms with the fact that our generation may not see the completion of this paradigm shift. It may be for the next generation to do. But at the very least, I think folks like ourselves are plowing the ground, taking a few risks here and there, and just pushing things forward a bit at a time.
Right.
And recognizing that these things do not happen overnight.
Yes.
But that's, eventually they do.
Absolutely. I have the website up right here, Daniel, on Thursday, September 7th at 7 p.m. at the Wilmette Theater. Dan will show his 85-minute documentary that you co-produced about the Skoll experiment. And so then also on Saturday, September 9th, the Chicago Ions at Evanston Hospital, you will be showing Calling Earth. So that probes into the phenomenon of ITC, as we talked about, instrumental transcommunication, and of course, EVPs. So two opportunities to absorb Daniel's research, to have a stimulating conversation afterwards, to be able to ask you questions and just sort of expand your consciousness. I think it's a must-see. Both films are a must-see for all. And a couple of thoughts also, Daniel. How can people reach you if they have questions and maybe thoughts after you leave? You know, sometimes these things absorb, take time to absorb. So how can people reach you?
I think the best way is to go to my website,
mm-hmm.
which is newscience2020.com. That's one word, newscience2020.com.
Mm-hmm.
And people can poke around there and see where I'm coming from. And then there's they can just click on my name and messages will get to me.
Fantastic.
From there.
Great. Daniel Drazen, so grateful for all that you do. Keep researching, keep asking questions, and let's hope that we can all witness this paradigm shift. And if not, you know, we'll come back through an EVP and say, I told you so. How's that sound?
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you so much, Jennifer. I really look forward to continuing our conversation at the Wilmette Theater.
I do as well. Thank you for all you do. Jennifer Weigel at jenweigel.com. And, of course, newscience2020.com is where you can find Daniel, his research information. And hopefully we will see you listeners at the Wilmette Theater and at Evanston Hospital. Everybody out there, treat others the way you'd like to be treated. Stay spiritual, damn it. And we'll see you next time.